Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 350 for December 31st, 2011, the final episode of the year. Support for Whiskey Cask comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. Coming up in a few minutes,
we will now be able to say that we take it from the barley right through to the bottle at Glengarry. Nothing leaves Speyside. Bottle to source.
Dennis Malcolm of Glengarry is celebrating his distillery's latest expansion. Plans are in the works to build a bottling hall at Glengarry that will open in March of 2013, at a time when most distilleries send their whiskies away for bottling. By the way, Dennis celebrated 50 years at Glengarry this year and had a Christmas to remember this past week. He retrieved a cask that he filled on Christmas Day in 1961, and he'll tell us about the plans for that cask later on. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, let's look at the week's news. As always, it's brought to you by Glenmorangie. We need to start off with some sad news. You may have heard about the tragic house fire in Connecticut that claimed the lives of three children and their grandparents on Christmas morning. The mainstream news outlets focused on Lomer Johnson's post-retirement work as a department store Santa Claus in New York City. What most of them did not mention was that Lomer Johnson was also the retired director of safety and security for Brown-Forman in Louisville. Retired Brown Foreman executive Robert Holmes Jr. told the Associated Press that Johnson spent his entire career trying to keep others safe, and the irony is that he died in a fire. Johnson's wife Pauline was also killed, along with three of their granddaughters. Investigators say Lomer Johnson was trying to lead one of the girls to safety through a second-floor window when he fell through the roof. Our condolences go out to the Johnsons' friends, colleagues, and family members this weekend. In other news, officials in the Philippines will review their taxes on imported alcohol after the World Trade Organization ruled the country's tariffs as discriminatory. The current system taxes imported alcohol at rates 10 to 40% higher than alcoholic beverages produced locally. Government officials will look for other ways to help the domestic distilling industry. If you've ever wanted to buy a distillery, well, there's one for sale in Kentucky. The owners of the Medley Distillery in Owensboro, Kentucky, have put the place up for sale, complete with warehouses and equipment. The asking price is $7.5 million. This week's American Distilling Institute newsletter also indicates the Medley Distillery's trademarks and aged bourbon stocks could be available for an additional price. It is a bit of a fixer-upper, though. The owners say the buyer will need to install some new equipment in order to put the place back into production. That's the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Don't forget to check out December's episode of Whiskey Cast Virtual Tastings. Our tasting panel took a look at several white whiskeys for the holidays. If you're interested in being part of the panel for an upcoming episode, just email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. Please put tasting panel in the subject line. We'll also be recording an episode of Whiskey Cast Virtual Tastings at the Victoria Whiskey Festival in British Columbia on January 21st. If you'll be there, you might just be selected for our panel that day. In the meantime, let's check out the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Had a lot of comments on last week's interview with Bill Ricker on the story of Mike Padlipsky, internet pioneer and whiskey connoisseur. It's a small world out there. I did not know it at the time, but my good friend Davin DeKergamo corresponded with Mike for many years. However, he had not learned about Mike's death and sent this note along. Sad news for me and the whiskey web, but I am glad I learned of his passing from a friend and that it was delivered sensitively and eloquently. He was brilliant and deserved an intelligent whiskey eulogy. Thank you. I know you have touched at least 1,500 other malt listers. Meanwhile, Ken Goldenberg emailed from California. Mark, it was as if my favorite podcasts collided this week with your guest Bill Ricker and his story about Mike Pedlipski. Was I listening to WhiskeyCast or to one of Leo Laporte's TwitNet casts, all of which, WhiskeyCast, MacBreak Weekly, and iPad Today, are always on my iPhone and are on my weekly listening schedule? Nice work balancing both subjects. Looking forward to your next 52 shows. Thank you, Ken. I asked, meanwhile, on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page this past week for you to share some of the whiskeys that you either gave or received as gifts during the holidays. Had a bunch of great responses. Nicholas Tylutsky, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, gave a Talisker 25-year-old, and he received the exact same whiskey, not the same bottle, though, as a gift, along with a Port Charlotte Honduras Moor and an Aaron Single Sherry cask. Kevin Kelly, meanwhile, gave himself a Merry Christmas when he found four of the five bottles that make up the Buffalo Trace Antique Collection while visiting his parents. Olivier Charlin sends along some good news. He talked with his father-in-law about bourbons a while back. Turns out Dad bought a bottle after their chat and now prefers it to his favorite Cognac XO. Congratulations on the conversion, Olivier. Finally, Matt Waller in Australia received a Glenmorangie Quinta Rubin, a Laphroaig Quarter cask, and an Aberlour Abuna for the holidays. Says he can't complain. I wouldn't complain about that either. Hope Santa was good to you during the holidays, and here's wishing you many more good drams in 2012. If you have something you'd like to share with our community of whiskey lovers worldwide, you can always post it on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, or just email me. My email is comments@whiskeycast.com, and the comments of the week are brought to you by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Let's check the calendar of events now, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. Since we're starting off the new year, I thought it might be good to go through some of the major whiskey events scheduled for 2012, so you can make your travel plans now. I mentioned the Victoria Whiskey Festival earlier. It's the weekend of January 20th through the 22nd in British Columbia. Whiskey Live London is March 23rd and 24th. Whiskey Fest Chicago is also on March 23rd. The Whiskies of the World Expo is March 31st in San Francisco, followed by Whiskey Live New York on April 11th. The Spirit of Speyside Festival is May 3rd through the 7th. The Spirit of Toronto Festival is May 12th. And the Isla Festival of Malt and Music, Fagiel, is May 25th through June 3rd. Tales of the Cocktail is in New Orleans, July 25th through the 29th. Maltstock runs September 7th through the 9th in the Netherlands. The Kentucky Bourbon Festival is September 11th through the 16th in Bardstown, Kentucky. The Autumn Speyside Whiskey Festival is September 27th through October 1st in Dufton. And Whiskey Fest New York is October 26th and 27th. Those are just some of the major whiskey events coming up during 2012. You'll always be able to find an updated list at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig, which will be sponsoring the calendar of events for the fifth consecutive year during 2012. Become a friend of Laphroaig at laphroaig.com and claim your own square foot of Isla.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Billy Lighton, Master Blender, Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey.
Redbreast is a reflection of Irish whiskey as it used to be and always should be, in that it reflects the pot still style, which is the tradition of Irish whiskey going back over the years. And if you take Redbreast, there's an age statement on the label, 12 years old. And that means that the youngest whiskey in that bottle is 12 years old. Doesn't mean that all the whiskey's 12 years old, because to get the mix right and the style, all the flavour characteristics right, we will use a range of ages, the youngest being 12, but you know, it can be a few years older in that, to get the whole thing together as I want it to be.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
Time now for WhiskeyCast In Depth. Saw some shocking news this week in an article that ran in The Australian. I didn't know this. You may not have either, but Glen Grant apparently closed. Well, that's according to Julian White. He's one of the owners of Melbourne's Chez Regine Whiskey Bar, and he was quoted in the article on why he charges $43 Australian for a glass of 49-year-old Glen Grant single malt. Here's what he said, quoting, "People are happy to pay that because we can explain to them why it's worth that much. The distillery no longer exists, and within 10 years they'll never see that whiskey again. So it's a small price to pay for such a piece of history," Mr. White said. End quoting from the article now. Of course, Glen Grant has not closed. "When I contacted Chez Regine," another one of the owners emailed me back, calling it a misprint on the paper's part. The reporter, meanwhile, tweeted this to me. "I saw Glen Grant still around. Apparently this dram is from a distillery they have since torn down. Could be wrong, though." However, Chez Regine's sample whiskey menu on its website lists Glenglassaugh under closed distilleries. Now, the bar's only been open for a year or so, and Glenglassaugh reopened 3 years ago this month. Just to make sure something didn't slip through the cracks Glen Grant-wise, though, I tracked down Glen Grant manager Dennis Malcolm while he was on holiday.
To sort of paraphrase Mark Twain, the rumors of Glen Grant's demise are greatly exaggerated, correct?
Oh, unbelievably, yes. It's going from strength to strength now.
Now, this comes as a complete surprise because I'm sure you didn't know that your distillery was closed, according to the Australian, did you?
No, I did not, and Mark, I'm glad the company didn't know because they've been paying me for the last 5 years.
And when we talked in Paris, you were just about to, you were telling me this story about what you were going to do on Christmas, and I wanted to touch base with you about that because you were celebrating your anniversary just a few days ago, right?
Yeah, I celebrated 50 years at Glen Grant on the 3rd of April this year, but on Christmas Day 1961, I filled some sherry hoggies, and they were laid down and matured in the warehouse for 47 years, and then in 2008, we took one of them out and put it into the cave up in the orchard and the gardens, just the way the major kept his special cask, and it's matured for the last 3 years in the open air in the garden. I have taken it out of there on Christmas Day, and it's now in my personal store below my office, and we are, through with James Bruton, the Global Director for Marketing, we are going to do a very, very limited special bottling. We're hoping to get 50 bottles.
The Angels took their share out of this, didn't they?
Aye, they did. And, you know, from time to time over the 50 years, I've checked the Angels as well, because my mother used to say I was a little angel, so I thought I was duty. I thought I had a right to taste it with the Angels.
How does it taste? I assume you did a final quality control check when you took it out on Christmas Day.
No, I did not. I'm doing that when I go back. On the 5th. We're opening up on the 5th, so we're going to take a little sample out of the cask and have a little look at it, check the nose, the taste, the color.
Tell me about, well, before we talk about those last 50 years, you've got some new news to announce with an expansion, right?
Yeah, we took out a 25-year-old Dussault in France, but I've selected another cask, which is 19 years old, and it's a cask that it had some Islay whiskey in it before, and Glen Grant was then filled into it, and it's got this very, very subtle smoky note to it, only on the, when you exhale, you know, you don't get it on the taste the same, it's just when you exhale through your nose, you get this lovely soft peaty note to it. So it's quite unusual. So I'm gonna do it at cask strength, and we have a special bottle, special label, special little carry bag. Everything is unique to it. We've moved away from the two Highlanders, and we've put a label of the Victorian building type building at the end of the courtyard, the main office of the boardroom. So it's a completely different label to it altogether. To make it that bit more unique, it will only be sold at the distillery shop, nowhere else.
And you also have some expansion going on at the distillery itself, right?
No, we've shelved that, and we've decided to go for a bottling hall instead. So we're gonna make all the product that we make for ourselves and then bottle it ourselves. So we've decided to shelve the expansion.
That's what I was referring to, was the bottling hall. But tell me about the plans for this, because it is rare that distilleries build their own bottling halls these days.
Yeah, but it's fortunate for us because, you know, we are a single malt, we're not a blend, so 100% of our product is all maturing at Glen Grant. So the liquid is made, it sleeps, it matures, and it's then just popped into our filling store, which is going to be our bottling hall next to our filling store beside the coffee shop. So the product won't move more than 500 meters in its whole life. So it's very convenient, and I think it's a nice thing to do to actually bottle at source.
Will this add a few more jobs for folks to work in the bottling hall from the area, or will you be using existing staff?
There will be extra jobs. We don't know exactly how many yet, but there certainly will be, because we are going to use the existing operators. We're going to stop at the distillery for 1 week and bottle for 1 week. And if we bottle for 1 week every month of the year, we should be able to fulfill our bottling requirement for our worldwide sales. And as the sales grow, all we'll do is increase our capacity a little bit at the distillery and bottle for maybe 2 weeks. So it looks very promising for us.
And the new distillery hall will be ready when? Or the bottling hall, rather, will be ready when?
The first case should roll off the bottling hall the end of March 2013. So a year from March coming. So it's quite a busy program from now till then to get the plans through the planning and get the building done and all the kit in, you know. So it's all out at the sort of planning and pricing stage just now.
Now, this is just one of many changes you've seen. As you mentioned, you celebrated 50 years with the distillery. This has got to be almost as close to a record with one distillery as anybody has spent in the business in a long time. So tell me about the changes you've seen in the place over the last 50 years, because I know when you were there as a kid, it was still the major was in charge, right?
Yeah, the major was still in charge, and he looked after me. He employed me as well, and we had our own drum maltings at Glen Grant, so we made our own malt, and we had our coal-fired stills with our worm tanks. And then we changed that, and we doubled the distillery in the early 70s. We took down the maltings and put in 8 large stills there, or replaced the 4 with another 4, so it was 8. And continued to produce there, and then we automated the plant. We put in controllers so that the guys didn't have to run about doing so much, take out some of the labor into it, you know. So we've moved really from a reasonably sized distillery to a very large distillery. But we can't say we're a very large distillery now, with Rosyle being built and McAllen doubling up and Glenlivet doubling up. So we're just sitting away at about 6 million litres or 1,000 barrels a week, which is more than enough for Glen Grant's future requirements, you know, for bottling.
What was your first job at the distillery?
Oh, my first job was as an apprentice cooper. I went in there as a wee boy at 15 and was taught how to repair bottles and make bottles by the cooperage squad that was there. So that was my first job.
Hard and then work, you worked your way all the way up, right?
Yeah, then I went into the production side of it for 6 years. Went through all the different process, through the maltings, the fermentation, the mashing, the distillation. And then in 1971, went on to the sort of the junior management style post then, which was called a brewer, you know.
Now, tell me about the major, because he's one of these unique characters in whiskey history that we don't always hear a lot about.
It was Major McKessick. It was a young major I was employed by. It wasn't the son of the founder. My grandfather was employed by the son of the founder, Major. He was a charismatic guy who took over the distillery in 1872 from his father when he died. And he was only 25, but he had a wonderful distillery. I say he had train loads of money, not bucket loads of money. And he was very much like his father, James, because James was the innovative one of the two brothers. He was the guy who founded the railways, the steam railways, in 1852, and then in 1858 he took them up to Rothes. And then in 1861, 100 years before I started, he actually generated electricity at the distillery using a water turbine. So he used the wastewater from the condensers and the worm tanks, passed them through a turbine and generated electricity for the house, for his house, for the distillery, and gave the village one light. But when he died, you know, the major took over in 1872. He was a bit like him as well, you know, innovative, because everyone was trying then to make a lighter whiskey, to make it more appealing, because in 1872, you'll understand, there was no bourbon cask then, so everyone was using sherry casks. So we all had a sherry finish, you know, but all different flavors and tastes as well with it, but our own character was there, but the sherry was always there. So when others tried to make a blend, he decided not to do that. But he was very bold and innovative. He introduced a purifier. So he put a purifier between the line arm and the condenser and made a very, very light alcoholic vapor, which gives us this light, fruity Glen Grant. Now, that was very, very brave, I say, because he didn't know what like that product was going to be when it matured, Mark. You know, it was a stab in the dark. You know, he didn't have laboratories to test out all the spirit to see the differences that we have nowadays. So he was a very, very bold and brave man to do that, but it paid off. But he was luckier than you and I. He had a train load of money to keep him going for the rest of his life. So if it didn't work out well, he didn't need to worry. But I maintain that, you know, you've got to protect the quality of the product. So that's the only thing that's stayed the same since I started there, the quality of the product. You know, I focus on it all the time.
And you have probably one of the more picturesque distilleries in Speyside to work at, with the gardens that the Grant family and that the major put together originally, right?
Oh, yeah. I think we're not just a distillery. I think we're a tourist attraction, you know. We're an environmental tourist attraction because the gardens are 27 acres, you know. They're huge. And it's beautiful to be able to walk up through the garden, see the distillery. Got a little coffee shop there. We've created a little nature trail for the children with little animals hidden all over there for them to see. So it's I think it's a family environment, you know, that we're creating in the distillery there.
One thing that doesn't always get mentioned, at least in current history, is the decision many, many years ago to expand by building what was then referred to as Glen Grant Number 2 and later became known as Capradonnac right across the road. What were you thinking a couple of years ago when basically that distillery was essentially torn down forever and became warehousing space for Forsyth's, the still makers across the road?
Well, if I'm 100% honest, which I have to be, I was saying, yippee. I'll tell you why. For two reasons, Mark. One, if anyone had bought the distillery and made a production unit again, I had to supply them the process water and also the cooling water for the distillery. So when the distillery was demolished, I then became the owner of a further volume of water, which can produce another 2.5 million liters of alcohol a year if I ever needed it for Glen Grant, because it's the same water.
Right.
And secondly, you know, when they closed that distillery, they opened it in 1898 and called it Glen Grant Number 2 and pumped the whiskey up to Glen Grant. And then it closed in 1901, and they said it was a world slump in the markets, a world recession that caused it. It didn't reopen until 1965. Now, I strongly believe that they noticed then that the whisky was different, because Cappadonnach spirit was completely different. If you nose and taste some of the older Cappadonnachs that's still around, it's completely different from Glen Grant. So I think they actually knew that and maybe used the recession of 1901 to forget about it, you know.
And then somebody forgot about it over the intervening years?
Yeah, I think they just intentionally left it there and said, well, let's leave it, because there was many opportunities between 1901 and 1965 to reopen that distillery and create more production, but I'm near sure that they noticed that the spirit was different, you know, it's completely different.
Now, those differences wouldn't have had anything to do with people drilling holes in the pipeline between the two distilleries, right? To tap into the spirit.
That was a big loss to the people of Rothes when the distillery closed. They couldn't do that anymore.
That may have been the easiest way to steal whiskey ever in Scotland, right?
Oh, it was for public access there. You know, everyone could get near it if they wanted. You know, but these days, I suppose they thought by putting the pipe up high on the warehouse wall that people wouldn't go up there for it, but they just popped a ladder up against the wall and drove a hole, and you could see the pipe shaking when they were pumping whiskey, so they would have just filled up their little container and then popped in a little wooden spile to stop it from leaking again.
That may have been what caused the differences in the spirit, I think.
maybe the lack of spirit, the losses were too high.
Almost like a public water fountain for whiskey.
Yeah, it was basically like that in Rothes, you know. It was like that in Rothes these days.
What's your best memory of the place?
Ah, gosh, I've got loads of good memories. You know, I loved it really when there were so many people there working. You know, it was like a little village because we used to have 48 people working there. And it was a fantastic atmosphere. It was all hand operated, but things change, you know, things change, and people change as well, and you've got to move with the times, you know. So we've got less people there, but we still have 13 full-time employees. We used to have 48 in 1979. So we've got quite a few people there now. And now we've got fantastic memories. I think it's all fun, you know. It's fun working there, and it's fun making whiskey, and I like people to be happy doing what they're doing. That's the most important thing, you know. And Glen Grant has always been very supportive of the community, the people in the community, you know, because Douglas Verkesick, the major's grandson, who took over when he died in 1931, he actually donated a piece of ground to the village, and that is the McKissick Park, which is the Highland League football ground. So we do loads of things. We support the golf club, we support the flower show, we do all these things. So I think it's all a community spirit, as well as a lovely single malt.
What are your future plans after 50 years? Are you going to stick around for a while?
Yeah, I'm going to stick around because I'm so excited about this bottling hall. I want to see this bottling hall churning it out and everything happening in Rothes. And Campari don't want me to retire for a lot of years yet, but I don't think I could stay as long as they want me to stay. I've still got this mad passion for making whiskey, Mark. I don't know what caused it. I don't know if my mum dropped me when I was a wee boy and I hit my head on the ground or what it is, but I'm so passionate about this industry. I think it's a fantastic industry. It's not just the spirit of the industry, it's the people in the industry that I like working with as well, you know. I think they're very sort of passionate about what they do, and I like to see the younger ones coming in with their new ideas, because without them you can never move forward, you know.
By the way, Glen Grant was also featured prominently in last week's episode. The single malt that Mike Pedlipski spent years trying to track down was distilled at Glen Grant just a few years after Dennis filled that Christmas cask. If you haven't heard that story yet with Bill Ricker, please listen to episode number 349. It's at the Whiskey Cast website and in the iTunes Music Store.
The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you by the Glenrothes. Let's start off with the 2011 edition of Middleton Very Rare from Ireland. It's bottled at 40% ABV, and the nose has notes of honey, oak, and hazelnut. The taste is thick with mild spicy touches of cinnamon and pepper, honey, and a slight touch of orange peel. The finish has a citrusy tartness with a touch of honey, adding balance. I'm scoring the 2011 Middleton Very Rare a 92. I mentioned Glenglassaugh earlier. There's a new cask strength 37-year-old release that will be available exclusively in North America. Bottled at 56% ABV, the nose has notes of toasted oak, vanilla, honey, and almonds. The taste is thick and oily with notes of black licorice, honey, brown sugar, and a subtle cinnamon note that builds up slowly and lingers through the finish, along with some touches of almond and vanilla. I'm scoring the Glenglassaugh 37-year-old a 90. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you by the Glenrothes, where maturity matters, not age. You'll find all of my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple version is also brought to you by the Glenrothes. And I'd like to thank our friends at Benromic for bringing you the Android app since its debut. The folks at Gordon & McPhail, which owns Benromic, have been good friends of the WhiskeyCast community for a long time. Without their initial support, we would never have been able to make the app available for Android users. You'll also find my tasting notes at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links for our Facebook community page, my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the photo gallery, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. I'd love to hear from you. Support for WhiskeyCast comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.